Hello and welcome to Running Dialogue, our inaugural movie podcast, a podcast about movies. My name is Kurt Holman, and I write for Creative Loafing Atlanta.
My name is Matt Goldberg. I'm the managing editor for Collider.com.
And my name is Russ Fisher. I am an editor at SlashFilm.com.
And I've got Oscar fever this morning. Actually, it might be strep throat because I have a sore throat and a mild temperature. But it was the Oscar morning. So what do we think about these gentlemen? Are we excited? Are we disappointed as usual? Or
I'm nonplussed. Mm-hmm. Is that the right word? Nonplussed. Yeah. I didn't feel like there were a lot of surprises. Mm-hmm. Maybe some minor ones. Mm-hmm. I mean, when your biggest surprise is sort of in the animation category, and you have a Secret of Kells, and it's like, yeah. What's that movie? And I mean, that's great. You want to seek out a movie.
Yeah, it's a secret. It's such a secret, no one knows what it is.
Exactly.
Yeah, until now.
Yeah. But I think that's a good thing on an award show, trying to cast light on something rather than, have you seen this Avatar movie? And I'm like, no, what's that about? But I mean, there are some good choices, and there are some things that bum me out, like Matt Damon getting nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Invictus, when I think Peter Capaldi should have gotten it for In the Loop.
Oh, yeah.
But then again, not that Matt Damon's a bad actor. I think he's great. But I think he should have been nominated for The Informant. And then, you know, Morgan Freeman, I feel he got nominated because he's playing Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
And if you don't nominate him for playing Nelson Mandela, somehow you hate Nelson Mandela.
You must not
Mandela.
Like Nelson Mandela. What do you have against Nelson Mandela?
Well, let's break it down for a second. I mean, the big thing is that this is the year where we're seeing the Best Picture category expanded from 5 films to 10. And so there are 5 films that were basically – that essentially had to be in there. I mean, you've got Avatar, Hurt Locker, Inglourious Basterds, which is a weird inclusion, but we knew it was going to end up being in there. Precious,
and then
Up in the Air. Like, that was the core – group, and it remains the core group, as evidenced by the fact that those directors also got Best Director nominations. But I think it's a fun thing, and I've been talking to a lot of people, just, you know, regular, not, you know, movie editors today, about the other 5 movies and the fact that it's kind of a neat thing because it's a great way to draw attention to those films. You know, we have like A Serious Man, the Coen Brothers movie. That's awesome that it got in there. And Education. And Education is a brilliant, fantastic movie that would never have landed a Best Picture slot in a field of only 5. District 9, yeah. Again, doesn't need the bump. Everybody knows what it is. It did very well. So it's not quite in an education category, but it's great to see it in there. That's a very cool thing. So I think that's the core news is 10 Best Picture nominations instead of 5.
Yeah.
And what does that do for each of those movies?
Well, and then the funny thing about it is that it works so well with those movies because, I mean – when they decided to expand it, I think partly because, you know, movies like The Dark Knight and WALL-E got shut off from previous years. They wanted to kind of make it more populist at a time when, like, the award show is not doing as well and things like that. And so it seemed like, you know, like The Hangover or Star Trek might get nominated. And I thoroughly enjoyed Star Trek, you
sure.
know, laughed frequently in The Hangover, but didn't really think them as deserving. But really, like, the only populist movies that, like, might be kind of ringers, you know, are The Blind Side, which is a huge $237
gigantic
hit,
yeah.
And Avatar, which ironically probably would have got the nomination anyway if it just been 5 things.
Right.
So these real tiny movies, you know, like An Education and A Serious Man got in. So it's like these are what these awards are actually supposed to do, you know,
right,
to draw attention
right.
to movies that people might not know about, which are really cool, you know. So.
And
so they did something right for a change, you know.
Yeah, and that's why I guess I'm more positive about it than anything else, because thinking about it, I expected it to go super populist, which, okay, fine, nothing wrong with that. But again, those movies don't need the ratification of an Oscar. They have the ratification of massive box office.
Right,
and huge marketing.
Yeah, Star Trek doesn't need any help from anybody. It did fine. It would have been kind of cute and funny to see it get a Best Picture nomination, but so what, you know? But instead, you got The Blind Side, which I'll confess I haven't even seen because I blew it off at the time, and now I'm obviously thinking, oh,
well, it had awful trailers.
Oh, the trailers were terrible.
But
yeah.
It was actually – I thought it was a pretty sweet movie, and I almost blew it off. Mm.
And that's what everybody said. A lot of people who saw the trailer and thought, oh, my God, this is the worst-looking thing in a long time, then saw the film and really liked it. And so it's interesting that that as a drama and as a drama that kind of crept out of left field to become a huge success is the big populist movie, like you say, aside from Avatar, which had to be there.
Yeah.
There was no chance that Avatar was not going to be there.
Yeah. Right.
But it's kind of funny. I don't know how much we want to talk about Avatar, but
not at all.
Yeah. But this is a film that, like, you know, people thought was going to be this, you know, probably not make its money back, you know, like there was jokes about Hitler seeing the trailer and, you know, it's, you know, Thundercats meets Fern Gully, you know, and stuff like that.
Okay, put the, yeah, for the people who might not know what the Hitler thing
is. The Hitler thing is, there's a clip from Downfall when, of this wonderful Hitler movie starring Bruno Gantz from Germany.
the Hitler movie.
It's a wonderful Hitler movie, yes, that's true, you know. Even more wonderful than Inglourious Basterds is a Hitler movie.
Don't forget Max.
Yeah, and there's this charge scene where his, like, basically his inner circle come and tell him that, you know, they're going to lose the war, and he loses his scheisse and chews them out, you know, and so people have taken that clip and instead of the German original subtitles have put in different subtitles of anything from, like, Hillary Clinton finding out she's probably not going to get the Democratic, you know, presidential nomination to, you know, him responding poorly to the iPads release. So it's
right.
This meme that it's probably about play, right, but still is,
I mean,
pretty,
it's been
funny,
going on,
yeah,
for years. The first time I saw it was like Terrell Owens being on a different team and how that messed up Hitler's,
yeah,
fantasy football,
yeah,
league. So,
right. But so it's turning in this movie that's like, as a story, no one seems to be that excited about, but experientially people love it so much that it's like the most popular movie ever now, you know, by just gross receipts,
right,
and may change Hollywood forever and may win Best Picture. So it's like, it's kind of odd, you know,
because, right,
it seems like a movie that they would never, maybe not nominate, but never give it to.
Although, know? I felt that the Oscar nominations were actually very fair in terms of what they nominated Avatar for. They didn't give it Best Song. Mm-hmm. They didn't nominate it for exactly. They didn't nominate it for Best Screenplay,
which the Writers Guild did do.
Yeah.
Although, and also the Writers Guild just had these insane rules that ruled out so many other movies. So,
right,
I think in some way that was sort of a lack of options. But,
right.
I mean, I don't hold a, you know, obviously it should be nominated for technical categories and things like that. But back in the Best Picture category, it really does seem to be coming down to The Hurt Locker versus Avatar, because they both have 9 nominations. Avatar has the box office going for it, but Hurt Locker has the critical acclaim, plus it won the Producers Guild Award, and Kathryn Bigelow won the Directors Guild Award this past,
right,
Saturday.
Yeah, this past weekend. So.
Yeah, so it definitely – it's a close race, and Oscar needs all those it can get, especially since it's most of its acting races are tied up at this,
yeah,
point.
And that race is – I mean, it really is The Hurt Locker versus Avatar, although I think that, you know, there are two dark horses, which are The Blind Side, mm-hmm, and then Inglourious Basterds.
Which got 8 nominations.
Which got 8, including, you know, including nominations for editing and cinematography, mm-hmm, which Avatar and The Hurt Locker also got. So you've kind of got those 3 movies have those big 4 nominations. Mm-hmm. But I think you really can't discount the guild momentum that The Hurt Locker has, because the same people who voted Kathryn Bigelow to win Best Director and who voted the film to win Best Picture from the Producers and Directors Guild are the same people who are going to vote on the Oscars.
Yeah.
So if they voted that film once, they're very likely to do so again.
Yeah. Although Inglourious, and maybe this is just because it has a large cast, but Inglourious won the SAG Award for Best Ensemble, and actors make up a huge block of,
right,
Academy voters. So,
right,
it's definitely not – you can't count it out. But at this point, it is looking like Hurt Locker versus Avatar.
Yeah. It's funny. I think that Hurt Locker being released at the same time as Avatar might be the best thing that could have happened to it, because there's this great narrative in the fact that James Cameron and Kathryn Bigelow are divorced. So,
right,
you know, I mean, that's this big story, and so it'll draw so much more attention to the Hurt Locker than if it had been against Slumdog Millionaire or something like that.
It certainly doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the film doesn't need it. The film is an incredibly strong piece of work, mm-hmm, and I don't I guess an ideal standpoint, it doesn't need that extra layer of narrative.
Yeah.
But having it doesn't hurt.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what the Oscars are about. It's like they're not really about merit, but it's cool when merit is in the mix.
Right,
you know?
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
And it's also interesting because, you know, this was such a front-loaded year, mm-hmm, that because most of the awards films come out in December, and then the awards momentum is supposed to drive up their box office, but most of the time it doesn't. It seems like the populist film just keeps going,
right.
And then the smaller films, they never seem to break out of the art house. But films like The Hurt Locker, it's on DVD and Blu-ray, so people can – they hear this nomination, like, I can go out and check that out right now.
Right.
A Serious Man will be out next Tuesday. So it's definitely not cut off, whereas Avatar wouldn't – I don't even know how that plays at home, but certainly not in IMAX or 3D or whatever. So I definitely think it doesn't need to be where if only Avatar was on DVD, you could get that audience desperately needs.
Right.
So.
I think one thing that was in the favor of movies like An Education and A Serious Man was that some of the more highly touted Oscar-to-be movies basically tanked or either weren't very popular or weren't very good, including like The Road or Nine
or
Lovely
Amelia.
Bones. Yeah, or Amelia. Yeah, so. And it's funny to me how, you know, when I kind of grew up, like the Oscar movies were real predictable, kind of these like kind of sweeping biopics and things like that. And that the rules seem to have gotten changed at some point, maybe in the past decade, where in the past few years, they've been mostly these kind of almost violent dramas that are sort of contemporary, like, you know, No Country for Old Men, even though it's in the 80s, and Slumdog Millionaire, and Crash, you know. So I don't know what wins the Oscars these days anymore. So,
well, the interesting thing about some of those movies that either tanked or didn't do well and didn't make the cut, i.e. The Road, Nine, Amelia, et cetera, you know, two of those movies are Weinstein Company movies, as is Inglourious Bastards. And so the company is still well represented, and it almost seems like they were kind of splintered in a way by, you know, The Road wasn't going to get any push because it's a great movie, but it didn't do well commercially.
I wonder why.
The thing is, The Road is not, to digress for a second, The Road is grim, but it is not depressing, I don't think. And that's a fundamental thing about the film that a lot of people – that was not communicated. And people saw that it was ashy and gray and post-apocalyptic and grim. But it's actually a hopeful movie. And had that been better communicated to people, I think the film might have done a little bit better. To
continue on The Road detour for a minute, my problem with The Road, though, was I found it – tonally kind of monotonous in a way that the book wasn't, because it didn't really have like I didn't feel like emotional highs or lows. So, and I figured there could have been more of like, we found this cache of food and that's awesome, and now these cannibals are after us and that sucks, you know.
But
it was kind of more like this kind of this level poking along and it sucks that it's the end of the world. You know?
I felt like that about the book.
Yeah.
And I didn't dislike the book. I appreciate the book and the film in much the same light, but to me the book was relatively flatline in terms of tone. So, and I thought the film represented that well for what that's whatever that's worth, which is obviously not very much.
Yeah.
I mean, all I really have to say about The Road is that I think it had the best product placement of 2009, where it's like Cheetos will survive the new survive the apocalypse. So that's good to know. But, you know, you mentioned the Weinstein Company, and it's funny, they actually, as far as the studio with the most nominations, they have the most with 13, because I believe it's Inglourious Basterds plus the weird ones for Nine.
Right.
Like, I mean, Penelope Cruz for Best Supporting Actress, I don't know if that speaks to their marketing muscle or the fact that the Best Supporting Actress category was pretty lean this year.
That's kind of weird, but on the other hand, the person that should have been in that slot is Melanie Laurent from Inglourious Basterds.
Right,
so
it's
a Weinstein Company thing one way or the other. So if it's marketing versus whatever, it almost just feels like a gimme, like, oh, we'll throw Nine a bone, because the whole point of Nine seemed to be as Oscar bait,
right,
and it failed. So here's a Best Supporting Actress that you're not going to win anyway, because Monique from Precious is going to take it. So, you know, we're not even really giving you anything. This is just a little nod in your direction.
Right, along with, I mean, I think it also got, what, art direction and
It got one of its songs.
Yeah, exactly. So, those other categories I'm not fully against, but like you said, it's throwing them a bone.
Yeah.
But you mentioned Melanie Laurent and Diane Kruger. I think other name. It's awesome in that movie, in Inglourious Basterds, and, you know, it seemed like, well, we can't give it. We're going to give Melanie Laurent. We're going to push her in supporting, so we're just not going to push Diane Kruger.
Right.
So it's like.
Yeah, and either of the two of them, because Kruger kind of came out of nowhere for some other awards.
And, for SAG, she got a nomination.
And either of them would have done well, but Laurent would have been fantastic to see in Best Supporting Actress there, or in Best Actress, which is really where she should be, but given the ensemble nature of Bastards.
Right.
The other snub that made me really happy, actually, was 500 Days of Summer.
We were talking about that before you got here. And, yeah, I mean, and it's like, I was saying, it's like, I don't hate 500 Days of Summer, but I felt like Annie Hall did basically the same story and the same structural things much better in a much fresh way. And nobody else who liked it seemed like didn't Annie Hall just do this? Like, well, we don't care. We like this movie, you know. So, and it's a nice little movie, but I didn't think it really was that innovative or, you know, on a strong level the way, like, a better movie would be, you know. So.
When you see the fact that 500 Days of Summer did not get the screenplay nod, for instance, and what did in its place is The Messenger, which is a fantastic movie that's easily on par with The Hurt Locker as being a great kind of interestingly apolitical war film. You know, I'm really, really happy to see that. You've got Woody Harrelson getting a Best Supporting Actor nod for The Messenger, and you've got it coming in for Best Original Screenplay, which to me was a gigantic surprise, but probably the happiest surprise of all of this set of awards. Yeah. And so seeing 500 Days of Summer sort of bow out so The Messenger could take its spot is a beautiful thing for me.
I kind of see In the Loop as being that kind of ringer because I think it got a lot fewer acting nominations and like kind of the awards up until now.
Yeah.
And it's in this weird category like District 9 because they're both nominated for originals. They're both nominated for adapted screenplays, but one is based on a short film that was probably made so they could make the feature, and In the Loop is based on a British show, kind of a spinoff of that, that probably not a lot of people outside of England know much about.
It's called The Thick of It.
Called The Thick of It, yes. So, and it's not even like out, I don't think it's out on DVD in the United States yet. So,
hopefully, it'll get that momentum based off In the Loop, which I think that's a film that people are going to discover over time, and they're just going to fall in love with it and hand it off to people. So while I don't think it found its audience in the theater, it's on DVD now, like so many others, and you can just sort of – people will check it out. And but, I mean, you mentioned snubs but also pleasant surprises.
Right.
I was surprised that Marvin Hamlisch's score for The Informant didn't get in. Mm. But in its place – I mean, I have nothing against that score. I think it's fantastic. But in its place was Alexander Desplat's score. I'm totally butchering his name. Mm. But his score for Fantastic Mr. Fox, which I also think is great.
It's fantastic stuff. Yeah. So I'm – Hamlisch is too bad because Hamlisch is this guy who has this sort of old body of work that has basically been forgotten about or never discovered by a lot of people who are under a certain age. And so to see him get a nod for The Informant would have been fantastic because his score really makes The Informant in a lot of ways. You know, between it's, you know, that movie is very much Damon's performance, the script, and then that score, because the score really keeps that movie on a certain tonal level.
Right.
And the way that it works with Damon's performance is a wonderful thing. So to see it get a nod would have been great.
It's also, though, I found it kind of an annoying score, like the like the kazoos and kind of the quacking sound effects. I mean, it sounds very much like the score of Woody Allen's Bananas.
Sure.
You know? And which is sort of like, I mean, I can appreciate the point going on, but it's sort of like, why are you doing this? You know, I almost would have liked a fake serious score, like the Coen Brothers score for Burn After Reading, which is almost like a parody of like a Bourne Identity movie or something like that.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I think the score helped because, I mean, the film, the tone, it seems like it's from the 70s. There's that sort of veneer to it. But it's, I think it adds to the humor because it takes place in the 90s. And, I mean, one of my favorite lines is when Mark Whitaker is comparing himself to a character, I think, in a John Grisham or a Michael Crichton book.
Yeah.
And so I definitely think Hamlisch's score helped out a lot.
Well, there are a lot of little things in that movie that underline just how nuts Mark Whitaker really is. And the score, none too subtly, is one of the things that does that. It puts what he's doing in context right from the beginning of the film when you don't necessarily really understand what's actually going on. You know, you've got this guy who fancies himself to be one thing, but between Damon's voiceover and the score, you really get the idea that he's much, much further out in left field than he ever wants to admit to anybody.
There's a lack of integration in there with psychological and in the world of the movie. Did mention a film that didn't get nominated also that seemed to get seemed to have gotten forgotten during the whole award season is Where the Wild Things Are.
Oh, yeah.
And that wasn't on my top 10 list, but I've liked it, respected it, and no one seemed to really care about it by the end of the year. I felt like it had more, it appealed to more people when it came out than it seemed to have stuck with them. So.
Yeah, I love the movie, but you're right. I've forgotten about it, and that sounds sort of mean-spirited, but that's not the case at all. It's weird. It's a difficult movie. It's not a pleasant movie in a lot of ways. And I think that compared to sort of the easy unpleasantries of Up in the Air, or sort of the whiz bang pow unpleasantries of Inglourious Basterds, those other movies are much easier to swallow than Where the Wild Things Are. And it's just all too easy to sort of sweep that movie under. I think that's going to end up being a film that has resurgences and that over the long run people really consider in a new light. But yeah, as far as awards now, it's a shame because it's a beautiful piece of craft.
Right. I think it just got sort of, like you said, buried under, it just never seemed to get that awards momentum, even though there were clearly aspects such as the visual effects and the score and songs from the film clearly, I think, could have gotten in, but it seemed to get buried because there was so much else this year vying for attention. It wasn't a lean year. Like I felt sort of last year was very lean in terms of what was worth nominating.
It almost seems like Fantastic Mr. Fox kind of hit a similar chord with on this kind of barrier between adulthood and childhood and nostalgia and quirky music and talking animals and things like that. So maybe people kind of glommed onto that because it's so much more conventionally entertaining, and that kind of got pushed onto a middle back burner almost. This is kind of off the top of my head here. I haven't really thought about that, but
Well, no, I think you're really right with the Fantastic Mr. Fox aspect. When I was writing about that movie after seeing it finally, because I was a bit down on Fox when I saw the initial footage, I wasn't all that impressed with it and was sort of yeah. And when I saw the movie, I was blown away by it. And the tagline that I was using as I was writing about the film afterwards was kind of, here's where the wild things really are, which I ended up abandoning because I didn't want that to be seen as a slight to Spike Jonze's movie. But I do think that they are very related in a certain sense in how they deal with stories that are ostensibly children's stories, but not really, in the way that they reinterpret children's stories, in a way that they deal with childhood growing up, all of these things together. Fantastic Mr. Fox was far, far more approachable, far easier to watch, easier to recommend to people.
Not a big hit either, though, unfortunately.
Sadly, no. Sadly, no. But I don't know. I think that of all the animated Best Picture nominees, it's the one that now, ironically, I kind of want to win.
I'm glad you made that because I can kind of see it winning. Now, since Up got the in the Best Picture category, maybe people will feel like, well, it got that.
And right.
I think people are kind of tired of giving it to Pixar every year, no matter how deserving the movies might be, and that this movie is so quirky and has lots of stars in it, too, which probably doesn't help, So
it would just be an odd win, though, because when you stop to consider, it's so Fantastic Mr. Fox is a – you think it's a better animated movie than Up, but you didn't nominate it for Best Picture, so why is Up there and not Fantastic Mr. Fox? Yeah. But, the way these nominations work, they nominate the films, and then when it comes time for the winners, they're not everyone's on the same wavelength, obviously.
Well, an animated film, with respect to Pixar and the Best Animated Film category and the Best Picture category, it's almost like a kind of the Hollywood journeyman system with respect to, working your way through one of the craft guilds or something like that. It's okay, Pixar's done their time in the Best Animated Film subset for a long time now, and this just happens to be the movie where it's kind of okay, yeah, we'll let you step up, so yeah, they basically got called up, and it's I don't know that that's the best way to do it, but I think that that's basically what's gone down this year.
Right. That's the award in and of itself.
In a way, yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised to see Up not win animated, and I don't think it has a chance of winning Best Picture.
Oh, no.
So let's talk about Up in the Air, well, which is, this movie that Jason Reitman's movie that has had a little bit of controversy based on the whole who really wrote the screenplay aspect, and where there's been...
Yeah, and before that there was the controversy over the real people.
Right.
And they thought it was a documentary, and they're talking about them getting fired, and it turns out it's part of this.
Well, it's funny about Up in the Air, because when the National Board of Review gave it their Best Picture, and the Southeastern Film Critics Association, which I'm a part of, so I elevate it more than I probably should, gave it its Best Picture, I thought, it's like it's a real zeitgeisty story, and everyone loves George Clooney, and it's very smart and well put together. And it's like, I thought that it would be kind of the default winner, and thought that it would be the Oscar winner. And it seems to have dropped off a bit, and I don't know if there's an actual backlash or people... as a dramedy, it's this weird... kind of nebulous category or what? I'm not the hugest fan of it, but I like it a lot. So what do you guys think?
I think the backlash is against Jason Reitman. Mm-hmm. I think that there's become this perception that he's kind of a jerk, and I don't have any side on that. I don't really care. I haven't thought much about who he actually is. But I've certainly seen and read a lot of commentary where people are sort of like, yeah, I don't know if we really like this guy as a guy.
Well, but Cameron is like the most unlikable person.
Well, but Cameron is
he goes big in everything.
Yeah, I mean, that's a different thing. That's kind of why I mentioned the controversy that sprung up, which I think is kind of a non-controversy about Reitman maybe taking more credit for the screenplay than he deserves, etc. These things have all been pretty well settled. But they keep coming up, and I think it's because people have, some people have decided that, I don't know if we really like this guy. Mm-hmm. And that I think that's hurt the film a little bit. Plus the fact of the David and Goliath narrative between Hurt Locker and Avatar, and, the sort of omnipresence of Precious and a couple of other things have just – there's only room for so many movies in the Oscar narrative, and Up in the Air is just kind of
– Yeah, Up in the Air had that sort of early momentum. I don't know if it has much – I don't know how much it has to do with sort of how people feel about Jason Reitman personally. And I can only talk about anecdotally about how people I know have responded to the film. I liked it. I've seen it twice. It's not one of my favorite films of the year, but I think it's well made, although I have some problems with it. But when I recommended it to people, they go in and they're like, that was not the movie I expected, because the marketing sort of sells it more as a sort of lighthearted jaunt, but the film really turns over its course. The first act does not resemble the third, almost at all. So it sort of turns in a way, and I think some audiences feel sort of jolted by that ride. They can't really go along with that transformation. Not to say, everyone's seen The Hurt Locker, but I think in the weird way, Up in the Air became a victim of its own hype, and it hasn't really lived up to it. And Hurt Locker sort of snuck in, and, films like Precious and Inglourious Basterds sort of dilute the pool until you have Hurt Locker and Avatar sort of rising to the top.
Mm-hmm. It's funny how I saw an article in the New York Times about interviewing a guy who sort of does Oscar campaigns. And he talked about, you could do these real kind of obvious campaigns for something like The Hurt Locker or Precious as these kind of underdog films. And how to sell Up in the Air, he said, was really hard because it doesn't fit in this obvious niche, even though, he said that George Clooney's appeal was the only kind of way to sell it. So I don't think that should, as an indication of merit again, but, maybe that's part of it too.
Yeah, I don't know, because I think that, the question is, where's the line between a film that's difficult to sell to an audience and a film that's difficult to get across to Academy voters? Because Academy voters, I think, have by and large probably all seen Up in the Air because it was that movie for a minute. It was, it did so well at Telluride. It did well at Toronto. It had these big festival opens that gave it a huge momentum. I mean, as soon as the first time it played at Telluride, people were like, this is his Oscar movie. This is Jason Reitman's Oscar movie.
And I think he will win an Oscar for it. But I think also once a film gets pigeonholed, it's out of the Best Picture race. So I think that film has a very good chance of winning Best Adapted Screenplay.
Right.
And Inglourious Basterds will – not only will it win Best Supporting Actor, but Quentin Tarantino will get his second Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. And so, because I think Oscar voters like to spread out the love a little bit, and so it's like, well, we're not going to give you Best Picture, but we want to acknowledge you made a good movie. So if we can give you an Oscar in this category, that sort of shows our respect.
Right, right. Yeah, and I agree with – I think that the best hope that Up in the Air has is Best Adapted Screenplay at this point.
Should we predict what we think will be the big winners, you know, or do we
– Well, I mean –
Because I think that they seem like the major seem all real locks, you know. I mean,
they do, right? Yeah.
I mean obviously Monique and Christoph Waltz – or Christoph?
Christoph Waltz.
Yes. Yeah. Monique and Christoph Waltz have won practically every award. You know, I mean, they're probably – You know, they probably won things like Grammys for their performances, you know, right. and their thing. Right. You know, award, they're probably winning awards they're not even nominated for, you know, those
exactly.
things. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's very difficult to imagine, you know, an upset in those categories.
Same with Jeff Bridges. He's getting it for Crazy Heart. Mm-hmm. There used to be a little competition between Meryl's the way the Best Actress category has evolved is very interesting. It used to be sort of Meryl Streep versus Carey Mulligan, Carey Mulligan for An Education, Meryl Streep for Julie and Julia. But now Carey Mulligan has sort of fallen by the wayside, and now it's become Sandra Bullock for The Blind Side against Meryl Streep. And it really looks like Bullock is the one who's going to get this award simply because Streep, it's sort of everyone knows she's great, and it's the. I think the thinking is she'll be great in another movie, and that's not to say Bullock won't be, but you know this is I think nomination 16 for Streep or 15 or 16, and she has two wins, and she's great in it. But I think this was really Bullock's year because she was also I believe the first actress to ever have a film gross more than $200 million at the box office to have the lead performance.
It's like the next to like you have to like remove certain like action films from the equation that have men in them in prominent roles. But I think since My Big Fat Greek Wedding, you know, it's like it's bigger than that. So you know, and everyone decided it's like we like Sandra Bullock. We're glad that she's back. You know, we want to give this to her in case she goes away again. You know,
so. Right. Well, hopefully she'll be smart. I don't think she's a bad actress. So I just hope she's smarter with her role choices. And I think this year we got a lot of her. And I think she was good in The Proposal. It was a fairly safe film. We're going to try to forget all about
Steve.
Apparently, we all remember it right now.
Well,
the
joke being that she's nominated for both a Best Actress Oscar and a Worst Actress Razzie.
Yeah.
Not that the Razzies mean a damn thing. They're kind of a tired joke at this point. But, there's a point to be made there that she was in The Blind Side, you know, and then All About Steve, which is a movie that, like you said, everybody would just rather forget.
Yeah. Well, do you all think Avatar will win Best Picture?
I think going based on the fact that the Hurt Locker won the PGA award, and that Bigelow has all of this momentum coming out of the Guild Awards so far, I think that the Hurt Locker is a slight front runner.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, it's hard to say. I mean, Avatar is it's Cameron, and he's. You know, he obviously has this power that we never
with
quite...
With the dark wizard.
Yeah, I mean, we never quite liked to admit, you know, like you were saying, everybody was predicting that Avatar was going to be a disaster, that it was going to... Well, not everyone, but there were widespread thoughts that, this movie's not going to even come close to replicating Titanic's success. And now...
I don't think he thought that it would. Maybe, maybe he did.
Hard to say.
You know, he might think that of every film he makes, but...
Exactly.
But no one's... Probably even people who were behind it didn't think it would be another Titanic-esque phenomenon, which
right.
it is. You know?
Right. And so, you know, granted, okay, sure, you've got ticket prices that are bolstered by $3 or $5 thanks to 3D price tiers and all that. But, you know, it's done phenomenally well, and I think discounting it is foolish. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line, I'm thinking and hoping that it's the Hurt Locker.
Mm-hmm. I always count on being disappointed. So to me, I'll go back to 2005 where I was so certain that Brokeback Mountain was going to win Best Picture, and you know, Crash was sort of there, and you know, and waiting in the wings. And I really don't like that movie at all. And then it just kind of swooped in there and took it. And so my thinking is, I want the Hurt Locker to win as well. I mean, among the nominees, I think in terms of personal favorites, I think I'd rather have Up win because that's my favorite of the nominees. But since it's really between Hurt Locker and Avatar, I prefer Hurt Locker to win. I think Avatar will probably win it, but we'll look back in 5 years and we'll still be talking about the Hurt Locker. But Avatar, we won't really be talking about simply in the way we don't talk about Titanic right now. Mm-hmm. They're both landmark films in terms of what they did in terms of technology, but they don't have the story to really hold up. And people want to – the films you go back to are the ones where you can dig deeper and keep talking about them. And Avatar, you talk about it as an experience, mm-hmm. but – you know, I mean, roller coasters are experiences. Yeah. You don't.
It's kind of like giving the Oscar to the greatest show on earth. You know, basically. Right. Yeah.
Well, what do you think is gonna?
Well, I was thinking about this and hoping that the Hurt Locker will, because there's this kind of, you know, David and Goliath narrative now, and that it's kind of the David movie, the underdog movie. You know, which it, you know, it might have been the Precious with the underdog movie for, you know, most of the end of last year. My concern is just looking at the all the nominations that Avatar's gotten in the technical categories, will people think, you know, this one, that one, and then it'll sort of get the sense of inevitability that it gets Best Picture. I think that they'll be really inclined to give it to Kathryn Bigelow as Best Director just because it's a historic thing, and it's like, you know, Halle Berry for Monsters Ball getting Best Actress. So, you know, I don't know. I would love it if Hurt Locker got it because it's my favorite live action film of last year and it's great. But you know, I think you're very wise to have that. You know, prepare for disappointment. I have a photo.
That's just how I approach life.
I have a photograph from I think the 1986 Oscars of me and a friend of mine at an Oscar party when Out of Africa won, and I've got this sort of stunned, depressed look, and he's got this eye popping mouth. Dropped look of outrage on his face. So, you know, it's an old tradition with the Academy Awards. Well, one thing that we want to do on this podcast is have movie picks, like for rentals and Netflixing and things like that, and maybe ones that aren't quite the obvious ones. So do you gentlemen have any?
My pick, see, I don't I know that Kurt and Russ have a much deeper cinematic background in terms of what they've seen, because they're like all old and stuff, and I'm all like young and fresh and don't know anything. But so my sort of films are ones I saw a while ago, and they just sort of hold up for me, and they're sort of films I feel are underrated. So I'm watching HBO a little while ago, and Basketball comes on, and I still love that movie. And I'm like the only – it's so weird. It's like he's coming out strong for Basketball. Yeah. But it's so weird because I like that movie. You know, there's an actor, Dian Bacar, who's – you know, never been in anything else, but he's so good in it. Mm-hmm. And Trey Parker and Matt Stone, they're like almost silent movie actors because their expressions are so exaggerated in this movie. And it's weird how the critique of sports films, I mean, just from the opening, this weird, you know, dramatic voiceover where they're talking about over celebration, and this team of linebackers starts doing an Irish sort of river dance thing, and you know they're talking about how teams are forced to recruit from, you know, prisons, mental institutions in Texas.
And there's a line about teams being traded to weird places, and like the Jazz was traded to Utah, where they don't allow music.
Exactly. So I like that movie. I'm trying to watch older stuff. In fact, Russ brought my attention many months ago to Wise Blood. And it's been I have the Netflix DVD. It's been sitting in my house. I've been trying to get a new entertainment system up, which I finally have. So that's sort of my weekend watch, finally. So I have a Netflix queue ready to go. Hopefully I'll have smarter recommendations for you next time. But, I mean, in terms of stuff coming out, obviously Zombieland came out today. If you didn't see it next week. A Serious Man comes out. If you haven't seen it, seen it. But I'm going to leave the better recommendations to you guys.
All right. Let me see. Where am I going to go with this? Okay, I'll make this slightly topical. So if you were following along with Sundance, which happened last week, last 10 days or so was the Sundance Film Festival. The big controversial movie out of Sundance was directed by Michael Winterbottom, who made 24 Hour Party People, a great film that you should check out if you haven't seen it.
Starring Steve Coogan, who's great in it.
Exactly. He directed a film called The Killer Inside Me, starring Casey Affleck and Jessica Alba and Kate Hudson, based on Jim Thompson's novel of the same name. And the movie drew a lot of criticism for being excessively violent in a couple of scenes, and was bought by IFC Pictures, so soon you'll be able to see it in theaters and on demand. But that leads me to a movie called, and I'm going to blow the title because it's French and my accent is non-existent, but a movie called Coup de Torchon.
Coup de Torchon.
Coup de Torchon. Yeah. Thank you. Directed by Bertrand Tavernier. Tavernier? Yeah.
Tavernier, yes.
And also based on a Jim Thompson book called Pop 1280. Very similar book to The Killer Inside Me, but he takes the sort of American daylight noir and transplants it to colonial Africa. And it's got the actress Isabelle Huppert in it, who's fantastic. And so it's this kind of story of much like The Killer Inside Me, of a small town sheriff who is a little bit crazy and is killing people when he shouldn't be.
They're both kind of misunderestimated men, too, to use the George Bush expression. You know,
exactly.
Who turn out to be very dangerous indeed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the thing about the reason to recommend this now is A, topical because of The Killer Inside Me, but B, the current DVD release is by the great Criterion Collection, and it was announced today that that is on the list of titles that Criterion just lost the rights to. So their edition of Coup de Torchon is going out of print very shortly, and it's a fantastic film, and it's a movie that once it goes out of print, you may not easily be able to get. So score it from Netflix, or it's one of my very favorites, so I would say buy it.
That's a great choice. And I was when you were leading up with The Killer Inside Me, I was thinking maybe I should pick Coup de Torchon. When I said that, Jim Thompson, who wrote the original novels that we're talking about, also I believe wrote the screenplay for The Killing, the Stanley Kubrick
and Paths of
heist
Glory
movie, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. So that's a good choice. I'm going to take my pick or picks actually from The Messenger, which is a film that I wasn't the He liked it okay, but wasn't as behind as a lot of people. But it's very reminiscent of two Hal Ashby films in my mind. Coming Home, a Vietnam film,
right,
with John Voight as, I guess, a paraplegic Vietnam veteran. And another one called The Last Detail,
oh, yeah,
which is awesome. And this is kind of what my pick is. And it stars Jack Nicholson and another guy. I can't remember who his name is, but they're basically two MPs who have to take this prisoner back to army jail, basically, and they kind of – and he's played by Randy Quaid, who's this young kind of geeky guy, and they basically take him out to show him a good time, and it's very funny and also kind of tragicomic too, and Hal Ashby is like kind of one of the great underrated directors. So it's a movie like you could like go out and see it, and you probably find very moving and entertaining, even though it's, you know, came out before Jaws and Star Wars.
Can I change my pick to Being There because of Hal Ashby? Yeah.
And with The Last Detail, the last time I checked, it was available to stream on Netflix. So if you use Netflix's streaming service, you can stream The Last Detail and consequently watch it very easily at home.
There you go.
So. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce French, but the film you mentioned, is that streaming on Netflix?
I'm not certain, but
because a lot of Criterion films recently came onto Netflix, which is fantastic because their films are must-sees. And, I remember, like, Che. I never got to see Che. It's 3 hours long.
It's
like 4.5, but it's on Netflix streaming, so it's one of those films. Oh, so it's not on streaming? No. Can you rent it?
Yeah, Netflix does have Coup de Torchon, which they list as Clean Slate, which is
the rough translation of
the title, though not really a very telling indicator of what the movie is about.
So, okay. Well, so once again, this was our inaugural edition of the Running Dialogue Movie Podcast. So this is Kurt Hallman with Creative Loafing, and thanking you for listening this long. And also, do you guys want to say your names and thank you again?
I'm Matt Goldberg. I'm the managing editor for I'm plugging my show. I'm plugging the website, Collider.com. It's not bad. I think it's a little crass, but I think it's an all right site. So check that out. And we should have this podcast up on the site later tonight. And
I'm Russ Fisher with SlashFilm.com, www.slashfilm.com.
Okay. And I guess the prawns of District 9 will be celebrating tonight. So thanks, and we'll talk next time.
Cat food for everyone. Yeah.